The blaze is Chris Bedford and former White House strategist and senior fellow at CPAC, Mercedes Schlapp, joins us to discuss the state of the U.S. presidential race and react to our exclusive interview with former President Trump. The Synod on Synodality enters its final week. The Vatican has renewed its pact with China. What does it all mean? The world over, Synod Central 2024 continues with the papal posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal. And later, author and film critic Michael Medved joins me to discuss the controversial new film, Conclave. And I spoke to the filmmakers. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. Oh, the show we have for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Follow me there. Lots to cover. Less than 2 weeks to go until Election Day here in the U.S., and the race for the president continues to heat up. Last week, we spoke with the former president and GOP candidate, Donald J. Trump. Tonight, for reaction and analysis of the race, we're joined by political commentator, senior editor at The Blaze, Chris Bedford, and former White House strategist and senior fellow at CPAC, Mercedes Schlapp. Thank you both for being here. Look, I don't have to tell you all, the Catholic vote will have a huge impact on this election. They are traditionally the determining factor in swing states, particularly throughout the Rust Belt. From some of the polling I've been seeing, Trump seems to be up among Catholics. What are you seeing, and why is he up? Mercedes, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, I'm part of the Catholics for Trump coalition, so it's been a real honor to be able to go out there and speak on behalf of the president in basically why Kamala Harris is an anti-Catholic candidate. I mean, she is completely extreme on the issues of abortion. And obviously, you saw how she didn't even show up to the Al Smith dinner, an Al Smith dinner where political candidates show up, they roast each other. You were there, Raymond, where you interviewed the president. I mean, it was such a missed opportunity for Kamala Harris. And I think for Donald Trump, look, I was with him just the other day, and he really, there is something that's happening to him. I don't want to say like a complete, absolute, full conversion, but, you know, when we are with him and he brings up the fact that he's going to play the Ave Maria, for example, or they're putting up social media postings on St. Michael the Archangel. This is something we have not seen with past presidents necessarily. And there's an openness to President Trump, and he understands and respects the Catholic voter. And I do have to say, the Catholic voter, for the first time, is finally speaking up and saying, we are citizens of this country. We need to be active. We need to vote, and we will not be silenced.
Chris, your reaction to what you're seeing. Why do you, I mean, last time he lost the Catholic vote by a very slim margin. Why do you think Catholics are moving toward Trump now?
Well, he's still behind Catholics nationally, but it's so hard to tell with the polls nationally because they just call people self-identified Catholics. Does that person go to Mass? Does that person actually believe any of the tenets? Is that person getting baptized, taking communion? It's a very different role of how people, if being Catholic just means you have a Celtic cross tattoo, then maybe that's not exactly a good metric. But Pennsylvania is a place that is more Catholic. It's a place you can go into the coal towns or the former coal towns, a lot of them, and find people talking at the bar about what the homily was. I've seen that in my own reporting, that what the homily was the previous Sunday. People care a lot more in that area. Members of the Knights of Columbus are vibrant in a lot of parts of Pennsylvania. And in Pennsylvania, Donald Trump is eking ahead. Now, I would love to see him actually be able to marshal a Catholic vote. I would like to see the Catholic vote return. We haven't really had a voting bloc since the bishops kind of gave it away in 1960, backing JFK, who, while Catholic, basically promised to not do any Catholic things as president. So pulling one together would be a wonderful thing, and you're starting to see the gains made in Pennsylvania.
Well, in those swing states, five of those seven swing states that you had, you saw that National Catholic Reporter analysis and poll, they had Trump up, in some cases, 12 points among Catholics in those swing states, which is interesting. Meanwhile, the Democrats are spending millions on advertising their support of abortion. Former President Trump discussed life issues with me and made some news. Here we're talking about the Mexico City policy. Watch.
Will you reinstate the Mexico City policy, which forbids international spending on abortion?
Well, I was the only one that did that, as you know. Yeah. No other president did that. And we're going to be giving that a very good, serious look. In other words, how that compares right. and competes with the states. But we'll be giving that a very serious look.
Mercedes, your thoughts. And in fact, George Bush, instituted this policy as well, as did President Reagan.
Look, the reality is that the key is going to be who is going to be running his domestic policy council, who's going to be part of the National Security Council, who's going to be part of his senior team when he goes to the White House. One thing that I've noticed is that, for example, he jumped on this bandwagon on the IVF issue, I think without fully understanding that for Catholics, I would say and for the Catholic Church, they are not in favor of IVF, right?
So, well, Mercedes, I'm going to cut you off just for 1 second because you run ahead of me and I want to play this bite. I asked the president about IVF and a religious exemption. OK, and I want you both to discuss this. As you know, he has this IVF mandate where insurance would pay for these procedures, and watch.
The other day you said, I'm the father of IVF. As you know, some Catholics feel, and the Catholic Church believes, when you implement this technology, you're killing embryos. Will you have a religious exemption to your IVF mandate for religious organizations and businesses that feel this violates my religious principles?
Well, I haven't been asked that, but it sounds to me like a pretty good idea, frankly. But even Catholics, a lot of them, they want IVF. It's fertilization, basically. Mm-hmm. And, they view that as helping a family, helping parents have a child. And it's a very popular thing, but certainly if there's a religious problem, I think people should go with that. I really think they should be able to do that, but we'll look at that.
Chris, I'll start with you, then return to Mercedes. This IVF issue and the Trump take on it has caused a firestorm among pro-life Catholics. Does that answer assuage some of the angst?
Yeah, I think it does. And I was super happy to see you ask that last week and to see all the play that it got internationally with papers picking it up all over the world. That's an important issue. I mean, pro-life Catholics have been the tip of the spear on pro-life in America and the world. They were on this and pushing this long before it was an issue to the other churches. And thank God we have so many allies now. But for all the work we have to do to make up ground to convince the American people that that first trimester abortions were still a problem and not just second and third, we have even more work to do on IVF. So right now, at least to carve out, while the American people broadly are in favor of it, I don't think they've really thought about the consequences of it nearly as much as they ought to, like the church has. In the meantime, to secure those kind of exemptions, to protect Catholic hospitals, Catholic healthcare systems, from being and nurses and doctors from having to take part in this, well, that's a great first step.
Mercedes, is that religious exemption enough to convince undecided pro-life voters that the Trump administration would be reasonable and open about their deeply held religious beliefs? And we should say, Kamala Harris this week, in an interview with NBC, dismissed any religious exemptions to abortion, for instance.
I do think that he's had people in his ear lately that have been like, this IVF thing is great, so jump right on it. Maybe we can get these moderate women. I don't know if that's going to work as a political strategy. I actually doubt that it could work. But, on the other hand, then these undecided Catholics who are pro-life are saying, okay, wait a second, I didn't really like his IVF answer, but Kamala's positions are just way too extreme. And I actually believe that even when you add the component of gender ideology and this whole, transitioning of sex and puberty blockers for our children, that is so anti what we believe in terms of protecting our children. So I think that's another issue that when you start adding up the issues for Kamala Harris, it is a very anti-Catholic agenda.
Chris, I want to talk about the treatment of Christians this political season, and I'm going to tie the Al Smith dinner to it. At a rally this week, a group of pro-life students attended a Kamala Harris's rally, and they yelled, Jesus is King. The vice president responded this way.
Jesus is Lord!
Oh, you guys are at the wrong rally.
The remarkable thing here, Chris, is the campaign did not clarify this. So Trump seized on the diss.
But while Kamala says that people who believe in Jesus don't belong to our rallies, in our movement, we love Christians, we welcome believers, and we embrace followers of Jesus.
Chris, what do you make of this fallout? And do you think it'll have any impact on Christian vote?
Yes. Yeah, so now we have an American Democratic Party that is honest with itself. I mean, for years, you had the wonderful Bob Casey Sr. in Pennsylvania, who was a pro-life Democratic governor, who was came from a Catholic background. His politics were probably more like what you would see today with the Trump populace. Now, compare that to his son, it's a very different story. Now, this has changed the Democratic Party. You can't be a Democratic candidate right now who's against trans ideology, who is for life, which means you cannot be a Catholic voter and vote for that. Now, it doesn't mean you have to vote Republican, but you're supporting a party that says unlimited access to abortion, trans drugs for children, and no religious exemptions. People who would say Christ is King are at the wrong rally. And at the same time, Kamala Harris is out there. She's someone who's tried to create religious exemptions for federal positions, completely unconstitutional. She likes to talk about the Constitution a lot, but not those parts. She's tried to block nominees, say that the people who are members of the Knights of Columbus were part of an extremist group. She is, well, I think anti-Catholicism has had a strain in American politics since the founding. She is probably the most vocal anti-Catholic candidate for a higher office on the national level that we have had in decades.
Mercedes, as you mentioned, we interviewed the president at the Al Smith dinner, President Trump, the premier Catholic political charity event of every political season. And I asked him about Harris's absence.
We're at the Al Smith dinner, yes. Of course. Tell me, why did you decide it was important to be here? And what message is Kamala Harris sending by not being here to Catholic voters?
Well, I think you're honoring the Catholic Church. And, you know, I've been a longtime supporter. And I'm surprised she's not here. I think she's the first one in many, many, in decades, actually, yeah, to miss it as a candidate. It was always been a tradition. So I'm happy only in that the Catholics are going to vote for Trump now. But, no, look, I have a special relationship with the Catholic Church, and I think it was very important to be here.
Mercedes, what message do you think her absence and that Molly Shannon video that she sent in conveyed to Catholic voters?
As first of all, Molly Shannon, you know, acting as the horrific Catholic smelly girl, as a Catholic girl myself, okay, I didn't think it was funny at all, okay?
I didn't either.
I watched this Kamala campaign, and I'm so perplexed. Every past decision that she's made has been like one bad decision after another. You know, whether it be the Bret Baier interview where she was just completely destroyed. I mean, you've seen this. The 60 Minutes interview didn't help her in any way. Like, it has been one thing after the other. Missing the Al Smith dinner was horrific. It gave Donald Trump an opportunity to show a lighter side of himself, where he's funny, he's kind of doing this happy warrior type of campaign that's really, you know, catchy and connecting with voters. He obviously made fun of himself, made fun of Kamala. It worked, and it worked even outside of that room. I think for Kamala Harris, she lives in constant fear of insulting her little identity groups, you know, whether it is the LGBT group, you know, community, or the pro-abortion community for her, or the white dudes for Harris. They live in this trying to satisfy their little, you know, niche groups. And I feel that it has cost her the ability to, you know, basically go out there and try to connect with voters. And so I think that it was just it was a missed opportunity for her.
Mm. Chris, speaking of Catholics, I asked the president, President Trump, former President Trump, about his impression of the Pope's voting advice. I want to play this for you.
The Pope was asked about your candidacy and Kamala Harris, and he instructed Catholic voters to vote for the lesser of two evils. Who do you think he means and why?
Well, I think he wants them to vote for me, and I stand for really everything that you stand for and that the church stands for, and she doesn't. She's a very different kind of a person. She's a Marxist. Her father was a Marxist and still is a Marxist. And they are not big into religion, I will tell you. And I'm not just talking about the Catholic religion. I'm talking about any religion. The whole Democrat Party has gone really radical left, and I'm the opposite. I am totally in favor of religion, and I also like the Catholic Church a lot.
Chris, your thoughts. I mean, obviously, it's a bit of tongue-in-cheek response there, but the substance is serious.
It is a serious substance. It was a tongue-in-cheek response, the kind of thing you get from Donald Trump. It was also the kind of thing that we hear often from the Pope, not really any kind of conclusions, so sort of a little bit of a muddying of the waters. And it's, you know, it's important to remember that our Pope is kind of politically, his history is more as a Peronist, which has populist, it has conservative aspects, it has liberal aspects, it has authoritarian aspects, and it's peculiar to his home country. It's not a political tradition that we really have in the United States. So maybe he and Donald Trump aren't going to see eye to eye. But it's actually obvious, and Trump talks about this in his response to you, which is wonderful, is that the Catholic Church and Kamala Harris, or Kamala Harris and all Christians and Kamala Harris and most actually organized religions don't see eye to eye on anything. And it's not only that, but there's open antipathy between them. Kamala Harris has had difficulty with Jewish voters, not all of them, but some of the ones who've been upset with her attitude towards towards Hamas and Hamas' sympathizers. And she's had problems with Hamas supporters in Michigan and other states who are angry about her continued support at the end of the day for Israel. She seems to have alienated everyone except for, exactly like Mercy said, some of those special interest groups, the BLM groups, except for the men, they're not really on her side, the LGBTQ plus Z groups who seem to be fully in support of her despite Donald Trump being kind of socially liberal on a lot of those issues. Those are the groups that she has sacrificed so much of the working class vote and the American vote to gain their approval, and I think it shows in the polls.
Before we run out of time, I want to get both your takes on this election. Less than 2 weeks out, I can hardly believe it. President Trump appeared at what was billed as a Latinos for Trump roundtable this week at Doral in Florida. Mercedes, I know you were there. This week, a USA Today Suffolk University poll shows Trump and Harris neck and neck overall, but the Democrats are losing voters among Latino and Black communities. The poll shows Trump ahead among Latinos by 11 points. And Black voters were shown to prefer Harris 72-17. But that's a much narrower margin than the Democrats have enjoyed in the past among Black voters. Mercedes, then Chris, your reaction to the polls. And do you believe these voters are being truthful with the pollsters?
Well, you never know about that, right? But I'll tell you, in states like Arizona and Nevada, I would say pockets of Pennsylvania as well, you know, there is a strong Latino presence that can make the difference. Remember, this election will be won on the margins. And so President Trump, I think, on his message of, you know, look, prices are too high, life is not affordable, I want to make things affordable again and make sure that you have money in your pocket. On top of the fact that, you know, they want to deal with the security issue that we've seen, this chaos on the border where drugs have come in, where people have died in the hands of illegal criminals that have killed innocent women and children and families. You know, he is sending a very strong message to Hispanics. And I would say on the radicalization when it comes to the issue of gender ideology and this sort of indoctrination of the children, that the Democrats basically they've lost their footing with the Latino women and men, especially with the Latino men. So here you have Kamala's coalition literally falling apart at the seams. More of the union workers supporting Donald Trump. You're seeing Black men, especially supporting Donald Trump, Latino men supporting Donald Trump. So her coalition is falling apart. Well, Donald Trump is picking up these extra votes that we would have never expected.
Chris, I want to give you the last word. You know, when I interviewed African-American men on the streets of cities a few months ago, 75% of them would not tell me on camera whom they were supporting. But off camera, they filled my ear. You can imagine. I'll give you the last word.
But I think a lot of the social pressures have dropped away broadly about supporting Trump. But that's not the same thing in the Black and Hispanic community, particularly Black women are major leaders who are still backing Kamala Harris. So husbands and boyfriends and sons may be quiet about that, but actually do that vote in the ballot box. And I think Democrats have made a big miscalculation here. They think they were pandering to such a level. They assumed that Black voters wanted crime and no police. The Hispanic voters wanted illegal immigration and no police. None of that is true. That's completely insane. And you're starting to see it in the polls in the way they're responding to Donald Trump.
Mercedes and Chris, thank you for being here for the insight. We will leave it there. Still no word from the Harris-Waltz campaign about joining us for an interview, but the offer still stands. Thank you both.
Thank you.
It's the final week of the Synod Central. I know you're all so sad, where we're bringing you the latest from the month-long Synod on Synodality in Rome. Joining me is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal from Rome, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gents, thank you for being here. The draft of the final document was distributed to all the participants at the Synod this week, and in the spirit of transparency, it's not available to the general public and remains confidential, not because of a lack of transparency, but to maintain a positive atmosphere of discussion. Bob, what are you hearing about the contents of the document, and what do you think it'll actually contain?
Yeah, you know, it's very hard to say. In the past, of course, there have been these, sometimes I call it not just a leak, but like a fire hose, but the delegates have been forbidden. They did not receive an electronic copy by email. They've been forbidden to photograph it or copy it. So there is this kind of irony that on the one hand, they're talking about accountability and transparency, and yet they recognize, and I think rightly, that there needs to be some discretion at times when you talk about things. So look, there's going to be the usual talk about women being participants in the church, but without going as far as deaconets. There's going to be talk about transparency and accountability. There's going to be talk about power sharing and making the church into a missionary church and synodality. But I don't really think there's going to be anything tremendously newsworthy as much as some people who are behind this would like to be.
Father, does anyone really buy all this confidentiality and secrecy is merely for the sake of a good discussion? Again, the Synod was about dialogue, which literally shut down dialogue, except for those hand-selected by the people running the Synod.
Well, of course, not having access to what they're deliberating means that we're not part of the deliberations, although we get the message that everyone's supposed to be participating. And it's fascinating because what this breeds is side events. You know, we had side events on women's ordination, on homosexuality. We've had press conferences in which women deacons are being pushed by certain members of the Synod. So people are discussing things, but it's all on the sidelines. Why not have this document made public so that the delegates can hear reaction from people out in the trenches?
Mm-hmm.
It's all, I have to say, part of a control mechanism which betrays their lack of confidence that people are going to see what's written and say, oh, this is great, we need more of this.
Hmm. Bob, you wrote a column in thecatholicthing.org that I want to get into. I love this title, The Conciliar Circularity of Synodality. In it, you write, in the end, as we well know from much previous experience, none of this really matters, except in the sense that it has created the impression that the church no longer knows what to do with itself, that it's groping around in the dark, trying out various ways of dealing with the divisions within, that radical changes are in the offing, or maybe not. It will be up to Pope Francis to make of this mess what he will. Let us pray for him. That's Robert Royal's article, bit of it, from October 23rd. Bob, is that really how this thing ends, with a whimper and a shrug?
Yeah, you know, I think so. But what I was getting at with that title is there's actually going to be yet another phase of this that we haven't talked about before. There's going to be a three-day conference at the Gregorian University that has Cardinal Hollerich and Cardinal Grech and two of the pre-secretaries of the Synod managers attending. And they're going to talk about the connection, the circularity over the past 60 years between the church that was proposed at Vatican II and the Church of Synodality. So as I said in that column, what I think they're trying to do is they know that there's not going to be anything that is really consequential coming out of this synodality. And so they're trying to attach it to the heady days of the 70s. And this is like they talked about is this the mature fruit of the ecclesiology? I think it's just one more kicking the can down the road because they don't know what kind of deliverables that they can get to that are going to satisfy people. They're not going to get female deacons. They're not going to get LGBT. And all those hot button issues are still going to be out there.
The Vatican also announced this week, with very little coverage, I might add, that they are renewing their secret deal with China. And this allows the CCP input on the appointment of Catholic bishops. Another 4 years of this. This renewal went forward despite the report by the Hudson Institute and our friend Nina Shea over there that at least seven Catholic bishops in China have been detained without due process, while others are being subjected to pressure, surveillance, and police investigation since the pact was signed 6 years ago. Father, this deal would endure until 2028. Your reaction to the renewal and the church's silence on the outrage committed against their own bishops and the faithful?
Yeah, this is one of the most regrettable things in my lifetime, to see the Holy See abandon faithful Catholics in order to entrust the selection of bishops to the Communist Party of China. If this model of having governments have a role in the naming of bishops, why is it that we don't do that in all the other countries of the world? We don't do it because the leadership of governments has nothing to do with the naming of bishops, and they shouldn't. The Catholic Church is the mystical body of Christ. Communist operatives and communist leaders should have absolutely nothing to say about who becomes the leader of the flock in China. But the Holy See, regrettably, has surrendered this into the hands of people who are hostile to the Catholic religion. This is an outrage.
Bob, very quickly, your reaction. I mean, there are Catholic bishops approved by the Xi regime at the synod, and they'll presumably be in the next conclave.
Well, you know, the two that are here, I heard the other day that neither of them speaks Italian, or maybe one of them does. One speaks a little bit of English, but neither speaks Italian. So I don't even know how they're participating. Can there be simultaneous translation from Chinese? I just don't know. You know, it's interesting. I think it was almost kind of pathetic in the announcement of the signing of this again. They went through these things that we were just talking about, that there were underground bishops who've been repressed. And, you know, the Chinese started a new diocese without consulting with Rome. And the only thing that I think that the Vatican was able to say is that the Chinese rehabilitated a 95-year-old bishop from the underground church, and they made him formally okay again. I mean, this is very sad. And it's very clear that they made a mistake coming into this, and they just can't let go of it.
Which brings us to the heroic former Bishop of Hong Kong, Joseph Cardinal Zen. In a blog this week, the 92-year-old prelate issued an appeal for prayer while outlining his fundamental concerns with this synod. We should remind our viewers, Cardinal Zen was one of the five cardinals that raised this issue in the form of a dubia with the Pope a few years ago. The cardinal writes this, "I think endless debate should be avoided, at least on the issue of blessing same-sex couples. If this issue is not resolved in the synod, the future of the church will be very unclear, because some clergy and friends of the Pope insist on changing the church tradition in this regard." End quote. Gents, the cardinal also questioned the gathering's legitimacy as a synod of bishops, given the inclusion of non-bishop voting members, echoing what Cardinal Mueller said last week. Bob, then, Father, your thoughts.
You know, I think I mentioned in our last episode that Cardinal Ratzinger, before he became Pope, said that this this way of kind of delegating authority to bodies that didn't really have a history in the church is very dangerous, because it dilutes the real authority in the church, which is in the Pope and the bishops. And as we keep seeing, the so-called dilution of this authority actually just leads back to the Holy Father's power without any check among the other bishops. There's been very few people who have kind of raised the fundamental questions the way that the Cardinal Zen has about the status of this synod. So, look, I think we're ending up in a mess, and that's why in that column I said it's going to be up to the Pope to clean up this mess, and we'll have to see what he does with it.
Father, your reaction. Cardinal Zen also points the finger at Cardinal Fernandez and those running the synod as sort of trying to grek, that they're engineering a sort of new vision of the church.
Well, we've heard paradigm shift in the past, which basically means we got to start over and do things in a new way. But yeah, if synodality now means that the Synod of Bishops is transformed into a meeting of lay people, religious, deacons, priests, bishops, if synodality means that, so my question is, well, why didn't Pope Francis name some lay people and some nuns to the College of Cardinals? I mean, what are we talking about here? Are bishops successors of the apostles who have a role in governance of the church? Because that's what the Synod of Bishops is. The same with the College of Cardinals. Why is it now that lay people can be in one place but not the other? The logic of synodality is destructive. If it means that lay people have a share in the governance of the church, that's a violation of the nature of the church as established by our divine Savior.
Yeah, there seems to be more confusion and double talk over this issue. Again, we keep hearing it, female deacons, or as Bob mentioned, deaconettes. Just after the DDF head, Cardinal Tucho Fernandez, indicated that the issue of the female diaconate was off the table. He's now saying, remember he said this, we know that the Holy Father has expressed that at this time, the issue of the female diaconate is not mature, and has asked that we not entertain this possibility for now. Okay? That's what he said on the 21st of this month. Then German Bishop Franz Josef Overbeck countered by saying this at the Vatican press conference this week. Again, he's a Synod participant. We must provide a new answer for the role of women in the church. We haven't found the answer to the lack of priests, and unless we change, we will no longer have priests in parishes. Father, what do you make of this back and forth, the mixed messaging that has become routine at this synod? And another German bishop, Georg Betzing, by the way, told synod participants that the question of female deacons will dictate whether women will continue to seek and find their home in the church. Your reaction?
Well, all I can say is if the Pope doesn't want this discussed anymore, why is it being discussed? Why is it being discussed by Cardinal Fernandez and these other bishops? They didn't get the message. No, we're seeing here an elaborate game in which hopes are raised, then dashed, raised again, complainers get outraged, people say, I'm offended, blah, blah, blah. How about we get back to the ground of reality? The Catholic Church does not exist with women deacons. It never has existed in Catholicism. So this is all a game to get women into power in the church. And believe me, as we said before, once you're ordained a deacon, the next demand will be priesthood and then episcopacy. This is all about changing the nature of the structure of the church. So I wish the Pope's wish, as he expressed it, would actually be obeyed by those who are under him.
Bob, any quick reaction to that? The back and forth on the female?
The very term that Cardinal Fernandez used, that it is not mature at this point, that the question is not mature. Mm-hmm. In other words, that it's still green. It might the fruit might come in later. That actually directly contradicts what the Holy Father said to Nora O'Donnell in that famous TV interview. He just said that the Lord set it up this way that women cannot be part of the ordained ministry of the church. So what they're going to do is they're going to set up, we've been saying this, you know, for years now on this show, they're going to have a kind of a parallel process that they hope for, or at least some people further down the line hope will kind of mature into, if not actually the ordaining ministry, something so close to it that you won't be able to tell when you go into church on a Sunday morning.
Before we run out of time, there are a couple of other stories we have to get to here. There's a scandal continuing to brew over the Vatican's role, and more specifically, Pope Francis's role in the recent attempt to reinstate a former priest, who was twice convicted of sexually abusing minors in Argentina. An interview with the Vatican's leading canonist seems to suggest that Pope Francis may be personally involved. Father, as a canonist yourself, you've been monitoring this story. Tell us what we need to know.
Yeah, a priest was accused of sexual abuse of minors at religious services. He was tried and found guilty. The doctrine of the faith gave the diocese the right to hold a trial. He was found guilty. An appeal trial was held, found guilty again. And suddenly, Archbishop Parra Peña, who was one of the officials in the Secretary of State, issued a decree saying that he's now restored to the priesthood because new evidence came in. And then a couple of days later, the bishop in charge of the doctrine of the faith of sex abuse cases said, that decree is null and void. That man has no competence to make this decision. So what's happening here is, after any trial in the church and the matter is adjudicated, the person who is convicted can make a personal appeal to the Pope and ask for the grace and mercy and favor of having the verdict set aside. That's the only process that exists legally, and it's not really a legal institution in the sense of being regulated by a trial or having an administrative process. Simply, you write to the Pope and you say, please take this penalty away. So the penalty allegedly was taken away by, according to Pedro Parapeña, following some kind of extraordinary process. Well, we need more details, because how did this arrive in the Vatican? Was it appealed to the Pope? What was the new evidence? Why was he found by Parapeña to be innocent now of the serious charge? Because they said he was guilty of recklessness. What is this? This is chaos. Canon law is becoming meaningless in the church when things like this happen. And I thank it's Archbishop Kennedy in the Doctrine of the Faith because he upheld the law.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to make that clear. Archbishop Kennedy, who's at the Doctrine of Faith, came in and invalidated that restoration to the priesthood, seemingly overturning the Pope's decision. Bob, once again, we journalists look at optics. What are the optics of yet another case where, again, allegedly, we don't know exactly, but clearly only the Pope has this authority, he may have been involved in defending a convicted abuser?
Yeah, from what I can gather from the various reports, this person was a friend of Cardinal Fernandez's from Argentina, and he may be known to the Pope. We don't know about that. And let's just, you know, for the sake of our audience, what this would amount to is sort of like a presidential pardon in the United States. So it goes entirely outside the normal legal system the father was talking about. And look, you can do that in specific cases. But I think, as Father has often said, you need some kind of public explanation for this, because this guy is accused of very serious abuses against underage people. It went through what seems to be very good, normal judicial channels within the church. And suddenly from on high, he gets this presidential pardon, or this papal pardon, if you want to put it that way. So this is not transparency. It is not accountability. And certainly, given how grave the damage to the church has been around the world because of these abuse cases, this is not, to use your term, the optics that we want to have if we want to give the impression that we've moved past that terrible period.
Yeah. Well, I thought the law had changed, Father. I thought the Pope had just instituted new canons, new legislative texts that if you're found guilty of abusing a minor or any sexual abuse, I thought it was instant excommunication. Wasn't that the story? Or certainly out of the priesthood.
No, the penalty for removal of the priesthood is applicable here, and that was what was applied. And the mysterious thing, of course, is Archbishop Parapeña says this man was guilty of reckless behavior. Now, wait a minute. He was found guilty of the most grave offenses against minors involving sexual abuse. Reckless behavior, that's not a sufficient answer. What was the evidence? Why was this decreed? Who decreed it? At whose behest? These are all questions that need to be answered, because based on what we know, only Pope Francis can receive a petition for a grace and pardon after a judicial sentence has been passed and then reconfirmed in a second court.
Okay, I've got a minute and a half. I've got to hit this story. It's really interesting. There will be one fewer cardinal elevated at the next consistory in December. One of the cardinals elect, a 62-year-old Indonesian bishop, Paskalis Syukur, was asked not to be created a cardinal. He's telling the Holy Father, I don't want to be made a cardinal because he has a desire to grow further in his priestly life, service to the church and God's people. Bob, very quickly, what's at play here?
Well, we're hearing rumors that he has a family, and you know, you don't want to condemn someone on the basis of rumors that appear in newspapers. We know that these things can very often be misleading, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me, because we've seen over and over again that there hasn't been really a systematic review and a careful. When you're going to appoint someone to a major position like being a cardinal, there's not sort of like the background checks that you really want to have with many of these people. So, look, I hope it's not true, but the excuse he's given doesn't seem plausible.
Yeah, no, it's an odd story. Before we go, Father, you can comment on this as well, but I've got to read this to you. Cardinal Fernandez of the Vatican Doctrinal Office issued a report to the Synod that encapsulates so much of what we've been talking about here. The report says the following, quote, only a vital, fruitful,
and reciprocal tension between doctrine and practice embodies the living tradition and is able to counteract the temptation to rely on the barren scleritism of verbal pronouncements. Father, first of all, I guess he means rigidity by sclerotic. Your thoughts here on what this means. Is this about using practice as a battering ram to basically throw off rigid tradition?
Well, when you start saying that there's tension between the church's tradition and her practice and her teaching, I get very nervous because, as a matter of fact, in the Catholic faith, the doctrine and the practice are in a unity and a harmony, and they support one another. Tensions arise when heresies are introduced in the life of the church, and people start to claim that the faith is otherwise than what it is. We're dealing here with a whole culture and phenomenon, as Bob said earlier, where teachings of the church are put on trial, where everything becomes provisional, everybody's nervous, what's coming next. And in the end, we're basically reduced to saying, well, what are they going to say tomorrow? Because today I believe this, but maybe they're going to say something tomorrow. That's impossible in the Catholic Church, but it's happening on the level of these discussions. You know, Cardinal Fernandez is supposed to be the one who confirms the people in the doctrine of the faith. And he's more or less saying the doctrine of the faith is always something that's under tension. And therefore, we have to kind of like stand by and wait and see where the fight ends up. And that's not what it is.
Well, the tell to me, and we've discussed this so many times on this show and in our segment, this idea that practice can be quickly revised so that the doctrine has to catch up. Just change the practice and we'll just change the words later. This is a real problem and a danger and a threat. And I was stunned when I read it from his own pen. That's a tell. And I think we all have to be very wary of that and watch it closely in the days ahead. Gentlemen, we will leave it there. Thanks for keeping us up to date on all the synod doings. For commentary by Robert Royal and Father Gerald Murray, visit thecatholicthing.org. And don't worry, we'll be keeping you updated on the ongoing post-synod study group discussions. More soon. Thank you, gents. There is a new film that you've surely seen ads for, and one that I've gotten a lot of questions about in the last couple of weeks, so I thought we'd do a report on it. It's called Conclave, and it purports to reveal the drama behind the process of choosing a new pope. The film is based on a book by author Robert Harris. It's a thriller with an outrageous stunt ending. For his take on the film, we're joined by syndicated radio host, best-selling author, Michael Medved. Michael, welcome back to the program. Delighted to see you. Tell me, I know you've screened this film. What was your expectation when you went in to see it?
Well, my expectation wasn't high because there's a long history of films about the Catholic Church that sort of view it as dark and conspiratorial and entirely negative. So the fact that the film concentrates on the Ralph Fiennes character, who is the dean of the College of Cardinals, and he's a very sympathetic character. However, you mentioned a stunt ending. This is an ambitious film. It's a serious film. The director, Edward Berger, previously directed the remake, acclaimed Oscar-winning remake of All's Quiet on the Western Front. The film is gripping and moving and fascinating until that stunt ending that you mentioned that ruins everything and is absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, let's not give it away just yet. I want to build to it. And I'll do a little spoiler alert later because it's important in our discussion. But as you mentioned, Edward Berger, the director, he won the Oscar last year. And I sat down with him this week, Michael, to probe why he would make a film about this topic, a papal conclave, as his Oscar follow-up. Listen.
Edward, you've said that there's an ethos to film making and that there has to be a reason to make a film. What was the reason in your mind to make this particular film?
Well, I was really interested about the ins and outs of a papal election, about what goes on behind those closed doors. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily only a papal election, but for me it stood as a larger political process. You know, it could have taken place in Washington, D.C. or within any big organization that's looking for the top job to fill, to see what happens when there's a vacuum of power and who wants to fill that, you know, and what that does to the person, but also to the what I really responded to, what my real reason to make the film was, is Rafe plays a character called Cardinal Lawrence that has struggles with sort of purpose or his reason for faith.
And Michael, another part of the difficulty here, the problem here, might be something that Berger referenced. He sees this as essentially a political struggle for the papacy, like Washington, D.C., he said. So this is more of a political or ideological battle than a spiritual undertaking. Did you find the characters here particularly well drawn? I found them kind of cardboard cutouts at a point.
Well, I think most of the characters, you're right, because they're people you're just meeting, and they're basically classified very simplistically in the film's terms as good guys or bad guys. But one thing that was fascinating to me was there was a very gracious treatment of Ralph Fiennes, who's one of the producers, by the way, who plays a character who is deeply sympathetic and sincerely religious. The difficulty is that because they are classifying the College of Cardinals as sort of separated down the middle by good guys and bad guys, what is fascinating about this film in a political sense is it's sending a message that what does matter in politics is not particularly your agenda or your platform, but your character. And the idea that so many of the caricatures on the College of Cardinals have characters that are deficient, that are hiding some guilty secrets in the past that do come tumbling out, that's a very difficult basis for a film.
Yeah, Michael, you mentioned Ralph Fiennes, who plays Cardinal Lawrence. He's the dean of this College of Cardinals, in charge of managing the conclave. He's also riddled with doubt. Watch.
Ralph, you seem to be drawn to these types of characters. The End of the Affair, Faith Healer, I saw you on Broadway in many years ago, even Hamlet. Is there something that draws you to these particular characters? I mean, this is a character wrestling with his own doubts. He almost elevates doubt to a cardinal virtue. I mean,
I think yes, he gives my character, Cardinal Lawrence, who's the dean of the Vatican, he's responsible for running the conclave, and it's his duty to give a homily, a sermon at the beginning in which he emphasizes the importance of doubt. And in this context, I think it's about being open. It's about avoiding certainty and rules and dogma that is, it has an emphatic structure and says that this is right and that's wrong. I think he's saying we have to be open. We have to be open for all kinds of stuff that we don't know, and that's doubt, that's asking questions.
Now, Michael, there you have the theme that really does run through the whole film, doubt and the repudiation of dogma and certainty. Compare this, if you will, to other religious epics like A Man for All Seasons or even Shoes of the Fisherman, where the certainty of faith beyond nature is what propels and powers those stories and those characters.
No, that's absolutely true. And you don't have to go that far back. There was recently, I thought, a remarkably good film made about the two popes, starring Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins, playing actually Pope Francis and the late Pope Benedict. And that film did not center on their greatness because of doubt. And that equivalent of noble character with the presence of doubt and uncertainty does seem to be one of the bases that leads to the film, as I indicated, and again, no spoilers here from me, but the end of the film is very frustrating. Even people with are going to have that reaction.
Well, look, if my email is any indication, Michael, the final election of the Pope in this conclave movie is going to infuriate serious Catholics. Because to Catholics, it's not about selecting a president or a king.
Or moviegoers. It's infuriating from an artistic point of view, not just a religious point of view.
Yeah, no, it ends up being a stunt and a total. In some ways, it does reinforce this idea, though, of doubt and certainty is an evil. You know, it does undermine that. But look, this is the selection for Catholics of a faith leader, a representative of Christ on earth, the vicar of Christ, who will protect the deposit of faith. Okay, here's the spoiler alert. Okay, I'm issuing this to all our viewers. The cardinal they choose in the third act is a biological woman with some birth anomaly. I asked the director, Edward Berger, Ralph Fiennes, and Isabella Rossellini about this.
There is a visual power to the composition of these scenes, the drama of this. Here's the problem I think you're going to have, and I've heard from a lot of Catholics. You all were raised Catholic, all of you in some way, or had some association with the church. I know you're going to get ferocious backlash for this movie from faithful Catholics. Is that a concern for you as you were making it?
No. To be honest, I doubt, but let me be surprised. I doubt that it'll be ferocious backlash. I hope it invites discussion, because all we need to do is discuss with each other, have an open discourse, be able to disagree with each other without hating each other, but learning from each other. That's the main thing about making a movie like this. That there's opposing political forces. Who am I to say who's right or wrong? You know, in the end, this one person wins. But we didn't try to make a critical or critical takedown of the church.
But there's an awful lot of internal corruption here at play in this conclave.
But these guys are also sainthood.
Documentation of corruption in the Catholic Church exists.
Oh, without a doubt, in every institution.
There are also other cardinals that are very spiritual.
There are a few of those. But the question is, did you all have any hesitancy when you read the script about this may inflame tensions?
I felt the opposite of you. I feel that the film is incredibly religious, because the religions deal with the mystery, the doubt, the non-answer. And the film, once finally they have the answer, and yet the film ends with this incredible mystery and his answer, God made me this way. And I think he's incredibly religious and kind.
Now, Michael, I thought Berger said they were against saying what was right and wrong. I'm not so sure Catholics will feel that way. And I wonder if they or anyone would make a movie about, say, a transgendered grand imam being elected. Your reaction?
Well, there are very few grand imams who appear in this film. But... Though they do have, and again, not to give anything away, but one of the members of the College of Cardinals is a cardinal who represents Kabul, which I don't think is a reality in the current constitution of the College of Cardinals institution. Look, the idea is they come back to making a film about the world's most prominent and important religious institution, which is the Catholic Church. And they make a film about that institution where the organizing principle of the whole film, and you heard it right there from the filmmakers, is doubt.
Yeah.
And this is a real problem in our society, and one of the reasons that people are so unhappy and so torn, and they all think that society is going in the wrong direction, because the highest virtue would appear to be, in the eyes of what we just heard from the filmmakers, the ability to feel doubt and uncertainty. And in terms of choices between good and evil, which sometimes are very clear in our world, and the idea of exalting the idea of a doubt above all other, quote, virtues, I think is dubious, to say the least. And for people of faith, including non-Catholic people of faith, I think this is a problem.
Yeah, well, basically, Conclave seems to suggest that all the things Jesus Christ taught are holding the church back. And if those things are overthrown, then the church can thrive. I mean, it's kind of a pagan's version of religion, all the ritual with none of the belief or dogma. You wrote an entire book years ago, Michael, about how hostile Hollywood is to religion and people of faith. I'll give you the last word and how this fits into that trajectory, if you will.
Well, it fits into the trajectory, not because this is so much a focus of Hollywood or Hollywood movies or television shows or programs or anything in mass media, what is a focus in mass media is a portrayal of America where the importance of religious faith in the lives of people is consistently downplayed. One of the points I make in Hollywood versus America, that book you're talking about from 1992, is the idea that every year in this country, there are more people who attend church and synagogue than there are people who go out to the movies. And it's not really close. Because despite the fact that, yes, people look at figures on church attendance, the majority of Americans still describe ourselves as believers in God. And the most people have some connection with and some identification with religious faith. And the fact that that is so underplayed in the depictions of American life across the country makes this movie worth pointing to, because it is, in so many ways, it's lavish. The sets and the costumes and the recreation of the Vatican, and there is a little bit of a sense of awe that is communicated here. All of that is going on, and yet the payoff is, as you rightly observed, I think very dubious, and one of those things that will frustrate moviegoers of every faith and of no faith.
Yeah, no, I was really looking forward to seeing it. I did see it. At the end of the day, I thought it was, you know, it's a lot of black smoke. We're still awaiting the white smoke from Conclave. Michael Medved, thank you for being here. And you can listen to the Michael Medved Show. Read his columns at michaelmedved.com. Thank you. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to tune in next week. Raymond Cardinal Burke will be here to offer some guidance to Catholic voters as they cast their ballots on November 5th. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.